I'm Frank Verastro, Senior Vice President here at CSIS and a Trustee Fellow for Energy, National Security, and Foreign Policy. And it's my pleasure to welcome our listeners to another installment of Energy 360, our energy and geopolitics podcast series where we combine the expertise of our regional scholars with the market perspectives of our energy practice. Today's focus is on the GCC in Qatar. And our guest is Dr. John Alterman, a Senior Vice President here at CSIS, holder of the Brzezinski Chair, and the director of our Middle East program. John, thanks for joining us today.
It's good to be with you, Frank.
So it's been more than 2 months now since Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, and Egypt broke diplomatic relations with Qatar, closed their airspace, and put in place trade and border restrictions that impacted overland and seaboard traffic of, among other things, food, medical supplies, and from the energy side, LNG and oil. Within days of the action, we co-authored a commentary for CSIS outlining the prospects and implications for the turmoil in and among the GCC nations, and the challenge for the U.S. to play a meaningful role in mediating this dispute. So we can get into the energy impacts in a moment, but John, since you've written extensively on this topic, can you bring us up to speed on the current state of play and where we are with the dispute and the mediation effort?
The dispute is much more in the same place that it was a couple of months ago than anybody thought was possible. There's Kuwaiti mediation. The Emir of Kuwait is coming to Washington in a few weeks to try to move this forward. The sides are trying to go together. But it seems that there was an expectation on the side of the Saudis and the Emiratis that this would force a profound change on the Qatari side, that there would have to be an immediate reaction. In fact, the Qataris have dug in. There have not been profound consequences on the Qataris. They've been able to use money and allies to get around many of the obstacles. There aren't food shortages. There's not political unrest. People are digging in. The Turks are helping out. They seem to be getting shipments from other places. The Omanis are playing a role. And I think we seem to be in for a slog. This increasingly seems more personal than anything else. Although there also is a very strong element, which this is a consequence of the Saudis and the Emiratis thinking that it's vital that there be more status quo powers in the region. And the Qataris continuing to believe that the region needs to change. And if Qatar plays a role opportunistically picking up allies here and there to try to move things in a positive direction, that's their sovereign right to do. How this will sort out between the Saudis and the Emiratis believing in the status quo in some version and the Qataris believing in change, I think you can probably find some middle ground, but it's hard to overcome this personal sense of betrayal and the personal animosity that is really coming to the fore here.
Which has been there for a long time.
It has been there for years. And one of the things that's new is you have a younger emir who took his father's position. He is in many ways less powerful on the global stage. He's certainly less sure of himself on the global stage. He's less interested in being on the global stage. The former emir worked generally in partnership and sometimes seemed to have given some slack to Hamid bin Jassim, who was his foreign minister. Very powerful global actor. One of the things that happened in the succession is Hamid bin Jassim was pushed aside. And it seems that Qatar in many ways still has the footprint of being a global power, but it doesn't have the ambition, the expertise that it had when it was being a global power under the previous regime. And I think that's partly why this is all coming back to bite them, because they don't have either the ambition or the capacity to shape events the way they did 4 or 5 years ago when the previous emir was in power.
So I want to come back to this issue of new alliances, right? The role of Turkey, the role of Iran. But one of the things that's happened in the last 3 weeks here that's noticeable is, and it's a tactical change, is the striving for public opinion. So we've seen Saudi and UAE funded advertisements on TV, in media, press ads. We've seen the Qataris now engage with lobbying agencies that were affiliated with former Trump campaign spokesmen. And they're all trying to present a different side. And at the end of the day, it seems like you just demean the whole process by taking your neighbor down with you, how you find a way. And then there's a separate issue of Secretary Tillerson versus the president and what they hope to accomplish. Because the U.S. has interests in a lot of these countries.
The U.S. has a lot of interests. And the U.S., of course, its largest Middle East base is in Qatar. We have about 10,000 troops there. To the extent that this hampers our ability to operate in Qatar, it hampers our ability to operate in the Gulf, which is a key strategic place where the U.S. is operating. I think what is happening is the Saudis in particular, who have been accused of terrorism widely in the United States, partly connected to 9/11, but partly connected to American discomfort with Saudi attitudes toward religious freedom and women and a whole range of other things. The Saudis are trying to say, we're not really the bad ones, the Qataris are really the bad ones. And the Qataris are responding, look, if you want to start talking about the excesses that people have, the Saudis have any number of excesses. A lot of what we've done has been in cooperation, coordination with the United States. And the reality is all those things are true, right? I mean, the Qataris have certainly done things in cooperation with the United States, and they have been frustrating to the United States. The Saudis are some of the most important intelligence relationships the U.S. has, and there are things that the Saudis do and people the Saudis support and condone that make American officials tear their hair out all the time. All those things are true, and I think, to me, the oddly missed opportunity is for the U.S. to take a central role, to talk to these countries and say, look, you're all our allies, but we need things from all of you. And for the U.S. to take a central role, not only diffusing the conflict, but also getting changes from the Saudis and the Emiratis and the Qataris in things the U.S. wants to pursue regional stability and counter-radicalization, all those different things. I think there are things on our list with all of them that we want. And instead, partly because the president and the secretary of state seem to be at cross purposes in what our approach should be, partly because the secretary of state, I think, has not been very sure-footed in acting as the U.S. chief diplomat. Not only is the U.S. not getting what it wants from these countries, but the situation is moving in a direction that makes the U.S. position in the Middle East harder to maintain, that strengthens a whole series of friends we don't want to strengthen, that breaks apart the GCC politically, which militarily, I think, will require a larger U.S. military footprint rather than a smaller one. I mean, it's almost as if the U.S. actions have been precisely counterproductive. This should be seen as an opportunity. And instead, it's seen as just another of a long list of problems in the Middle East that we'll get to when we get to.
Well, and it seems like it came on the back of the GCC and the MENA conference that was held in Riyadh, where the countries committed to fight terrorism. And then within days, you know, the Saudis and the UAE put out the statement about the 13 principles or the 13 objectives that they wanted, including getting rid of Al Jazeera for the Qataris. And then that was softened to 6 principles. But it still seems to me that there was no face-saving way out of this without major concessions, which kind of goes back to your earlier point.
Well, I think, you know, their frustration is they've gotten concessions from the Qataris before and the Qataris haven't delivered.
Follow through.
And I get that, and there's validity to it. What seems to have happened was that the Saudis and the Emiratis in their discussions with the White House saw an opportunity, thought the president was giving them a green light to take more initiative on their own. I would guess, based on what they've said publicly, that they criticized the Qataris, and the president seems to have said, yeah, you're right. Certainly it's consistent with his tweets, and it's consistent with their statements and actions. And so rather than the U.S. finding a way to move its allies together, the U.S. highlighting this issue not only drove our allies apart, but provided opportunities for some of the people we're trying to keep out of the Gulf to have a bigger footprint inside the Gulf. And that's just counterproductive. That's not in U.S. national
interest. So do you see this long-term as threatening the GCC cohesion, which was always kind of questionable at best?
It does threaten GCC cohesion. I mean, even if you find a way out of this, and I think they will find a way out of it, I think it will take several more months, but the scar tissue that this created, I think, is going to be an enduring bit of scar tissue. And as you look at a whole series of other things going on in the Gulf, you look at what I perceive to be an increasing U.S.-Turkey difference, partly based on Syria, partly based on other things. As Turkey tries to create a different relationship supporting Qatar and pulling apart from the Gulf, and Iran has its own interest, and there's a Turkey-Iran relationship which is evolving. Just, I see all of that not helping the U.S. either secure the Gulf or create more cohesion among our Gulf friends so we can step down our footprint and have others play a more self-sustaining role, which, as far as I can tell, is precisely what the U.S. is trying not to do in the Middle East, right? I mean, there's a sense that that we can be endlessly involved, and we have to find ways to create more stable systems that don't require a constant engagement intervention, and we seem to be moving in the opposite direction.
Yeah, because that requires that there's a lot of spade work to make those institutions happen so that they can do things on their own. I remember going back to the Arab Spring, you had made a comment early on about what we were looking at is decades-long turmoil and changes, new generations coming in, new leaders, new sense of where the world was going, and then with the U.S. role kind of backing down as the regional policeman, if you will. But other countries were going to either take a more aggressive or opportunistic role, including Russia, different parts. So it's expanding kind of the sphere. But when vacuums open up, they're frequently filled, not the way you want them to be necessarily.
Well, and there's a generational piece to this, that for many years we're used to the Gulf monarchies being ruled by 70-somethings. And this is being pursued. The elder statesman in all of this is Mohammed bin Zayed, who I think is 54. Mohammed bin Salman is 31.
Right.
I forget how old the Emir of Qatar is. It's not very old. Perhaps about 40, if not a little younger. These are men who in many ways have not seen the price of disunity the way some of their fathers and uncles have seen. I think they are staring at a whole series of domestic challenges tied to the economy, tied to not only the current energy price, but expectations for the future energy price, growing populations, growing sense of entitlement, larger workforces, all those kinds of things. And the challenges are large. And I think they're, while intellectually they feel that cooperation is good, I think that they don't have the same appetite for messy compromise that kept the Gulf together through hard times in the 80s and 90s. And whether they come to see it, what mistakes look like, what they interpret to be a mistake, what they interpret their successes to be, I think we're going to go through a period of learning, some of which is likely to be uncomfortable.
Right. But it's also at a time with lower energy prices and lower government revenues, which is going to make the challenge that much more difficult to meet the expectations of the domestic population.
And you know, the other piece of the domestic population is they have been brought up to treat other GCC states as their cousins.
Right.
I mean, this is very painful. This is the Thanksgiving dinner from hell, because here are people who really have not only traveled amongst, but really believe deeply that they are kin, and many of them are kin. There are a lot of families that cross these boundaries. And this is extremely disturbing for a lot of people in the Gulf, because it's a whole different way of looking at things. One of the things that I find notable, though, is that the Dolphin pipeline remains open, that the Emiratis continue to buy Qatari gas. There seems to be an effort to not go fully nuclear on this. How does that work in the energy field? Is there sort of a sense that there's some things you can't touch?
So the old energy adage was business is business, right? So even if there's disputes, whether it's among clans or tribes or neighboring producers, that the commerce of energy still goes on. Well, the economic impacts of the boycott are somewhat being felt by the Qataris, not as bad as it could have been, but lower economic growth. The energy impacts, as we talked about in our commentary, after 2 months have been minimal. So Qatar is a very small oil producer, certainly relative to its neighbors, about 600,000 barrels a day. They are, however, a large gas producer. They supply 30% of the world's LNG that moves big source of revenue to the government. And you're right. So even within the Suez Canal never being closed, even though Egypt had issues, the Dolphin pipeline, which supplied Qatari gas to Oman and the UAE, never closed despite the dispute, just shows that the business needed to go on. The Iranian-Qatari piece is a little bit more interesting, only because they share this giant field. It's the North Field for the Qatari side. It's the same basin as the South Pars Field on the Iranian side. And now, as a result of this, they've kind of stepped up efforts to increase or expand development, which they had put a moratorium on several years back, to increase the gas flow in an already crowded, I would argue, global gas market. So that's going to cause some concern for other competitors, other high-cost competitors around the world. U.S. is looking to be a net exporter of natural gas this year, big gas exporter into the future. But Qatari LNG is pretty inexpensive relative to other global supplies. And you may see new ties going between producers and consumers. You know, who's going to need that gas? Is it more, they supply 70% of their gas goes to Asia.
Does increased development in the North Field require them to have a different kind of relationship with Iran? Is there a It does require
a different type of relationship, but also a more enhanced and cooperative relationship, right? Because they're draining from the same basin. And I think that may probably be an opportunity for the Iranians to kind of get into the GCC that way. It gives maybe the prospect of exports to Europe through Turkey, which is another prospect for the Turks to be looking at, to be the transit country hub for a variety of gas supplies going to Europe, you know, arguing on security side that they need something other than Russian gas.
So would we
pick your poison.
So we would expect the Iranians, so as the Qataris increase production, then Iranians would also increase production.
So the Iranians have been increasing production, and they've got condensate. They're actually moving their refineries to run on condensates and a lot of the light gas, because they have a lot of gas. Their oil production seems to be stalled at a little less than 4 million barrels a day, until they can get increased new investment, which I suspect, at least initially, will come from the Chinese, the Russians, and some of the European companies because of the concern over U.S., for example, sanctions being reimposed on Iran. So it's a delicate balance right here, but the gas market is the big piece. The oil market, we haven't seen much of an issue at all, partly because of the small volume of production coming out of Qatar, but also because the initial boycotts on port movements and where you could fuel ships, so refueling, these were logistical workarounds. So people use smaller ships. They decided that the sequencing of their loadings in the Gulf would change so that they could move stuff out without going to a port where they couldn't enter. And that generally involves longer transportation times and higher costs. But it hasn't disrupted the market. And like I said, the oil and gas markets, at least now, are both seem to be in surplus situations, so we haven't felt that. Like down the road, I think the competition on the gas side could increase.
And does that change the Qataris' sort of long-term trajectory? Qatar has made a large investment in natural gas, which fueled tremendous growth. Qatar, for about a decade, had the largest per capita income in the world.
Yep.
If we look forward to an environment in which U.S. natural gas production is increasing, Iranian natural gas production is increasing, would you expect global demand growth to continue enough that Qatar remains a very wealthy country? Or is Qatar facing what many people think Saudi Arabia is going to be facing, which is a world in which lower energy prices mean the government can no longer do what the government got used to doing for about 15 years?
So the prospect right now on the gas side is that the world will be awash in gas, at least through the early 2020s, which actually could put the stifling impact on some of the U.S. LNG export facilities. If you don't get to financial decision to make it on a go-ahead basis this year, end of this year at the latest, you won't be able to deliver gas in the early 2020s, right? And then a lot depends on what the climate accord is. So in the United States, we've always felt the demand in Europe is flat or declining. United States power demand is flat or declining. If we lose nuclear, there's a chance that there could be a domestic surge in terms of appetite for natural gas here, along with renewables. But that would make U.S. gas prices higher. So their competitiveness in the export market might change a little bit. For Qatar, it's the same thing. You've got Australian gas now. You've got gas coming out of, in the near future, out of places like Mozambique, new suppliers that all think that they have this bridge fuel that people will use. And the question is, how long will it be a bridge? Does Europe and other users decide that, well, you know, gas is good, but it's not great. But if they don't have nuclear and other options, you can't get there, at least in the near term, with just renewables alone. So the gas market post-2022 could be an interesting market. But if you're a country right now, and it's 2017, and you've got a five-year hiatus before you start seeing a lot of new revenue rolling in, you're really rolling the dice on what that market looks like.
And are there bottlenecks, both in terms of the Qataris' ability to export more gas to the extent they can find markets, or countries' ability to import more gas?
So Asia is the big demand center, right? If you look at even the IEA data, that 60 to 70% of any energy demand growth over the next 35 years, it's not coming from the OECD countries. It's east of Suez, so it's Africa, Middle East, and Asia. But Asia, China, Japan, India are kind of the big users and where that would go. And the question is, what does their domestic policy look like? What are relationships with certain nations? And do those geopolitical relations translate into energy contracts, right? So business is business. But if there's a preferred trading partner, So U.S. role, what does the U.S. role look? I thought one of the things that was interesting is the Europeans, when the last round of sanctions, we are getting far, far afield, but the last round of Russian sanctions that passed the Congress talked about putting limits on U.S. companies or European companies' involvement with Russian partners. And the Europeans basically went ballistic and said, we need these new pipelines. And if there's joint ventures between our companies and the Russians to deliver gas to Europe, then what does that mean for our energy security? And then they read in context, or maybe a misinterpretation or a threat, that this U.S. energy dominance, that we were going to be the LNG exporters of preference throughout the world, and the notion that they felt, ironically, that the U.S. was now taking away the prospect of other potential suppliers and was going to use the energy weapon to push U.S. exports to Europe, when 5 years ago they were begging the Obama administration to increase applications for and licenses for U.S. exports so that Europe would have access to U.S. gas. So, you know, the political rhetoric and domestic agendas are coming into play here. And there's long-term, mid-term, and short-term implications of what they do. But it's getting to be a more complicated game. Is there a path forward out of this? You know, you talked about this going on for a long period of time, and that in some cases it's personal, in some cases there's new leadership. If the new leaders see that it's beneficial to reach some kind of an arrangement, even if it's not perfect, do they do that, or we're not in a position now to actually see people walk this disagreement back because it's so personal and it's escalated so much?
Look, I think it can be personal, but at the same time, if you look at the real-world consequences of some of the trends, of the Iranians having a bigger foothold in the Gulf, of the U.S. finding it more difficult to operate, you know, families being torn apart, and I think there are any number of reasons why it would be in the interests of the parties to say, okay, we're going to declare victory and move on. There's no question. I certainly was aware of deep tensions between Qatar and its neighbors. I think those tensions are going to persist, but the dramatic nature of the current actions, I think, creates longer-term patterns of behavior which the Saudis and the Emiratis don't want to encourage. So I think over time we're going to get to a better place. It's hard to see how that is right now. I think American leadership can make a big difference, because nobody in the GCC, I should say, wants to turn away from the United States. I think the United States has unexploited leverage of tremendous, tremendous power. And I think as the U.S. government thinks about what it needs to do and thinks about the tools it has, the U.S., in cooperation with Kuwait and some of the other countries, I think can play a very constructive role. The U.S. has to think it's important, and the U.S. also has to think that the current patterns are counterproductive. I don't think all the problems go away, but I certainly think we can step this down several notches and get to a more sustainable pattern, which also will involve both the Qataris changing some of the things they do and the Emiratis and the Saudis changing some of the things they do.
And on that note, sobering though it is, but upbeat, let me thank you, John, for joining us today, and thank our listeners, and join us again in the future.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Frank. Thank you.
Thanks, John.